It's Friday, June 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, the Taliban abducts civilians from a bus in Afghanistan. The United States targets North Korean financial activities in the U.S. banking system.
That signal was received, it's reported, so that has helped to identify the area for search.
Signals detected in the search for a crashed Egypt Air jet. Also ahead, millennials shop differently and a different way to see a movie on Snapchat. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Regional officials in Afghanistan say Taliban abducted at least 17 passengers in the north of the country late Wednesday. A provincial governor spokesman says the passengers, who were local residents of the Balkhab district, were traveling by bus to the capital of Saripul province when the Taliban kidnapped them. This is the second mass kidnapping in a week by the Afghan Taliban. International Edition host Susan Yonke spoke a short time ago with VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim from Islamabad.
Well, what we know so far is these 17 passengers were all local residents of the Balkhab district in the Saripul province, and they were just going from their district to the provincial capital when along the way they were interrupted and kidnapped by the Taliban. Until now, local tribal elders are trying to negotiate with the Taliban for their release. We don't have information as to how well that negotiation has gone so far. But what we do know is that earlier in the week, only 2 days ago, the Taliban had carried out another mass kidnapping in the Kunduz province where they held some 200 or so passengers. They just set up an illegal checkpoint on the road and just got people out of their vehicles. But eventually they released most of them, although they executed 17 of them for either working for the government or favoring the government or multiple excuses. So while the local elders are negotiating for the release, the relatives are, of course, really worried.
Meanwhile, the hundreds of protesters gathered in Kabul today for a demonstration. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, exactly. So after the Kunduz abductions and killing of passengers, there were several hundred protesters in Kabul today. They were led by the Afghanistan Green Trend Party, and the party is headed by the former intelligence chief, Amrullah Saleh. They chanted anti-Taliban slogans. Initially, they were stopped from getting inside close to the presidential palace, which led to a bit of tension, but eventually the government allowed them to move to a square near the presidential palace, and they read out their resolution, and eventually they went home. But this was just an effort to show the Taliban that these tactics are not appreciated.
What has the government's response been to this violence?
Well, the government has, of course, condemned this violence very strongly. They have said that this is, they've tweeted about it, they've sent press releases about it, they've condemned the Taliban for doing it. And all this while, the one thing the government says to the Taliban is, it's time you put down your weapons and come to the table and become part of the political process. Of course, with the new Taliban commander in charge, the likelihood of that happening is less rather than more.
VOA's Aisha Tanzim in Islamabad. Meanwhile, from a different part of Afghanistan, a Parwan police chief said four people, a woman, a man, and two of their drivers, were stopped and killed. They worked for the non-governmental organization Focus International. We turn our focus to social media and International Edition's G. Abby Lee, who's here to bring us what's buzzing online. Hi, G.
Hi there.
Well, what are we talking about today?
Jim, it's been a while since we learned about the death of music legend Prince, and today we know the likely cause of his death. People around the world are talking about what a medical examiner said, that is, he died from accidental overdose of opioid fentanyl. I got that right. The Midwest Medical Examiner's Office released documents Thursday and listed the cause of his death as fentanyl toxicity.
Well, to bring our listeners up to date, just in case you didn't know about the unfortunate incident, he died back on April 21st at his home near Minneapolis. He was 57 at the time. And what's the online reaction like?
There are some negative reactions to the media's portrayal of his death. AP was one of the first to tweet about it, and the breaking news tweet reads like this. Law enforcement official tells AP that tests show Prince died of an opioid overdose. Nearly 3,000 people retweeted that so far, and one of the most liked comments to that tweet is critical of the news outlet. The user wrote, "It's irresponsible of AP to mention the overdose without mentioning it was due to mismanagement of chronic hip pain Prince had." She added, "He wasn't a junkie." So I would assume she's upset that that might actually give a negative portrayal of Prince's use of opioid. Others still argue the news report should be taken for what it is and nothing more. They were writing on Facebook and Twitter that it's not an official statement, although the statement did come from the examiner's office. Jim, the latest discovery also got the press reporting on fentanyl, which is supposedly sweeping the United States. It's a painkiller that's estimated to be 50 times more powerful than heroin.
That's extremely strong. Well, what is the buzz about that?
Well, let me give an example. Filmmaker Michael Moore, who leans on the left side, sent out this tweet. "People are serving long prison sentences for using heroin, but a pharmaceutical company making a drug 50 times more potent than heroin, and it's illegal. It's legal, Prince, RIP, that stands for rest in peace." Something to think about. Back to you, Jim.
That is. That's quite an observation from Michael Moore. Well, thanks for the wrap-up, G. You may tweet your questions and comments on this or anything else on your mind to our Twitter stream at VOA underscore IE. You may tag myself and G on those tweets. We're at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top Asia stories we're following at this hour, Pakistan enforces new border crossing regulation on Afghans. India convicts 24 for Gujarat riots massacre. International court ruling on China-Philippines dispute could be vital. China nervous about possible Britain-EU exit. The United States takes steps to further cut off North Korea from U.S. banks. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website. And if you have a smartphone, check out our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. South Korea Thursday welcomed the U.S. decision to label North Korea a global money laundering concern aimed at further isolating Pyongyang from the global financial system. A foreign ministry spokesman in Seoul said it reflects Washington's firm will to carry out U.N. Security Council Resolution 2270 and impose strong sanctions against North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby on Wednesday announced the Treasury Department's proposed new action. It's aimed at preventing direct and indirect North Korean financial activities within the U.S. banking system.
North Korea has been identified as a jurisdiction of primary money laundering concern under Section 311 of the Patriot Act because North Korea uses state-controlled financial institutions and front companies to conduct international financial transactions that support the proliferation and development of WMD and ballistic missiles. This action complements a series of U.S. and international actions to protect the international financial system from being abused by North Korea and to counteract its ability to finance the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and develop its illicit weapons programs.
The South Korean Foreign Ministry spokesman says the latest U.S. move could be more far-reaching than the 2005 action against the Macau-based Banco Delta Asia. That action led to a freezing of $25 million in dozens of North Korean accounts. An end to the freeze led to a short-lived North Korean promise to dismantle its nuclear program. Troy Stangarone of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute explains to VOA's Victor Beatty what Washington hopes to accomplish with its latest action.
What this means, in essence, is that North Korea would be prohibited from taking and utilizing the U.S. financial system. Because the United States dollar is the world's reserve currency, most transactions in the world, which are done in U.S. dollars, end up transiting through the United States at some point. And in doing so, they then go through U.S. correspondent accounts. And while there are already prohibitions on North Korean access to those accounts, this would preclude both access to those for these types of transactions and indirect access as well. So what it does is it raises essentially the compliance standards, the due diligence that banks would have to do to take and ensure that North Korea is not either directly or indirectly accessing the U.S. financial system.
Is this anything related to what the Bush administration did late in its tenure that really caused a howl out of North Korea and that eventually were pulled back?
This would be somewhat different. In that case, the United States had gone to the bank in Macau. They took and they demonstrated how North Korea was taking and utilizing that account specifically to fund its WMD programs. Specific assets were frozen. Now, that being said, one of the things we're seeing as countries go through and take and implement the recent UN sanctions, you have, for example, Switzerland, which put in place a freeze on cash and assets of anything that they determined to be perhaps potentially benefiting the nuclear or the missile programs. So you are seeing some of that going internationally, and this could lead to that, but it's not specifically just related to that.
If those really caused such a bite, why are we implementing this piecemeal, it seems, and not just going back to that if it really does hurt?
One of the challenges we have now is that it's been, in essence, about 10 years since the BDA action was taken. What we've seen since that time is North Korea has become much more sophisticated in how it utilizes its money. It uses both front companies and foreign individuals to take and set up accounts that do not seem to have direct ties to North Korea itself. It also utilizes much smaller amounts. It conducts business in cash in many cases, so some of this may not go through banks. So what we're trying to do right now is to take and place as many restrictions as possible on North Korea's ways to take and move money around the global financial system. And so it's a much more cumbersome process.
Meanwhile, the UN Security Council unanimously condemned recent North Korean failed missile launches, calling them a grave violation of previous UN resolutions banning all ballistic missile and nuclear activity. A French naval vessel using underwater sensors in the Mediterranean appears to have detected pinging signals, that is, from a so-called black box of an ill-fated Egypt Air flight that suddenly disappeared from radar May 19th while en route from Paris to Cairo, killing all 66 people on board. Anthony Thomas, director of aviation safety and security at the University of Southern California, says searchers are reasonably confident the radio signals are indeed coming from a black box because it's at a certain frequency.
However, it is only really just one source of data that's going to help them locate that wreckage. There is on every commercial aircraft what's called an emergency locator transmitter, ELT, which sets off a radio signal on impact, and it is received by satellite. That signal was received, it's reported, so that has helped to identify the area for search. And while the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder maintain data of a digital nature, the signal that is used to transmit them is a real sound. It is a sonic signal. It's not a like a radio signal, so it can be heard. While we can frequently depend upon the information on the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder, it's important to recognize that there is additionally on modern aircraft what's called a quick access recorder that is downloaded almost on a daily basis so that the aircraft operator can monitor the condition of the aircraft. Additionally, modern aircraft have actuators. They have many computers throughout the aircraft so that a lot of systems are no longer activated by pneumatic air or by hydraulic fluid, but are activated by electrical motors that are controlled by many processors, many computers. So it's important that we recognize that there are different parts of the aircraft will contain data. And similarly, while we're looking for that flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorder, there may be a single part that really contains the key to determining what happened.
If they can be recovered, the flight data and cockpit recorders could offer some vital clues as to the fate of the aircraft. There are lots of ways to watch a movie, but Snapchat users recently were treated to a creative presentation. But first, people who were born after 1980 and reached adulthood around the year 2000 are called the millennial generation. Millennials are shopping in a way that's very different from past generations, with consumers from China setting the trends. VOA's Elizabeth Lee explains from the affluent shopping district on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills, California.
Rodeo Drive. This famous street draws people from around the world. The rich and sometimes famous shop here. For the brand conscious, it's the place to be.
It's the brand you need to see. If you can see it, it's better.
Consumers in emerging economies go for brands, but that's starting to change in China, says this global retail trend analyst.
But what is fascinating about China is the pace of change in attitudes and behavior seems to be far quicker than other emerging markets such as India or Russia or Brazil, who are changing, but not that quickly.
In China, affluent millennials are starting to not wear visible logos.
I don't really look at the brand. I like clothes that suit my tastes.
It doesn't really matter. If I like the style, I'll buy it.
The Chinese traditionally like international luxury brands, but their attitudes about products made in China are changing.
After I pay for it, I may be curious and look to see where it's made. But whether it's made in China or made in Indonesia, it doesn't really matter.
To something more subtle is a sign that consumers from an emerging economy like China are maturing, says Sonu Shivdasani, the founder of luxury resorts in Asia.
The Rolls goes, it's all about showing that you have taste and discernment. So you might buy a silver BMW and go and shop at Armani.
Whether it's the Chinese or consumers from another country, analysts say millennials are setting the trends.
Millennials are now the largest segment of the population across the world. There are differences in many ways. I mean, the one element is they grew up with technology, and therefore there's something that they manipulate incredibly well and incredibly quickly and efficiently.
Millennial consumers often use technology to find the best prices and places to shop.
There's no such a thing as one price for all anymore. The price becomes much more a result of who you are as a person and how you've interacted with a brand in the past.
Personal data collected on the internet leads to tailor-made pricing for each consumer. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Beverly Hills, California.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. Social media star Andrea Russett has more than 2.5 million subscribers on her YouTube channel. Wow. But her fans weren't sure what was real and what was pretend last month when they watched her Snapchat feed. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, Russett and her friends shot a Snapchat movie that included going on a camping trip and ended in a horrifying nightmare.
Is that the Sick House website?
You're really gonna go.
Are you gonna tell us the story?
There's the three rules. Don't make any noise.
You hear that?
Never go inside.
Don't be nervous.
And you always leave a gift on the porch.
The film is called Sick House, and it was shot in real time using iPhones over a period of 5 days. It was then published on Andrea Russett's Snapchat feed. The film follows a group of friends obsessed with social media as they go camping in the woods and decide to explore an abandoned, haunted cabin. Russett says that she didn't tell everyone that her Snapchat feed was part reality, part fiction, And that had some of her friends concerned.
I actually, when doing the whole project, I didn't tell a lot of my friends what I was doing because I wanted to see their genuine reactions and see if they believed that this was real and happening. And I got so many of my friends texting me being like, oh my God, thanks for the invite for camping. Like, I would have loved to gone. Or like another girl texted me and she was like, are you okay? Like, I haven't heard from you in a few days and your Snapchat is getting me worried.
Because Snapchat posts are deleted after 24 hours, the clips had to be compiled to make a full-length feature. But Russet says that acting for Snapchat had its own challenges.
At first, I wasn't acting as a character. I was being myself because it was my Snapchat. So we had to start off being very much myself and then gradually becoming this other character. So that was kind of interesting to take it from literally being myself to someone else without people really noticing, I guess. And yeah, the whole like one take type thing. We could obviously do it a few times, but you do it once. And then if you really like that take, but you're like, we could do it better, you can't like save it and go back, you know? So that was a little tricky, but we made it work.
Guys, there's someone in the house.
Did you see that?
Did the door just slam? The door just slammed.
Did anybody else see that?
But me? We're going home right now. We're leaving. We're going home right now.
We're not going anywhere. It's pitch black out.
Where the hell is the car?
Andrea Russet says it was exciting to take part in the project, but she doesn't think that Steven Spielberg or J.J. Abrams have much to worry about from social media movie moguls. At least not yet.
I don't think people are ever going to lose interest in watching, sitting down and watching a movie, you know, but I think it's interesting to try out these new different things. Like, would it work better if we sat and watched it like 10 seconds on Snapchat, then like a half hour later, 10 more seconds? It's interesting to explore it, but I don't think it's ever going to become where people don't want to sit down and watch a movie.
If you would like to see the full version of Sick House, it's available online, of course, at Vimeo. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Like Snapchat, we're here, we're gone, but just for a little while. You can always find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Under President Barack Obama's landmark Power Africa initiative, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, recently launched a new assistance program that aims to improve power distribution performance and increase connections in Nigeria. The two-year agreement will provide management consultation to three Nigerian distribution companies. The agreement will also advance major infrastructure investments and strengthen systems in the distribution companies. U.S. Ambassador James Entwistle witnessed the signing in Abuja between USAID partner Power Africa Transactions Reforms Program and the chief executives of the Abuja, Benin, and Eco Distribution Companies. We believe that distribution companies are the starting point for improving the entire power sector value chain, said Ambassador Entwistle. Through improving the performance of distribution companies, we will see increased electricity supply and access. Our joint efforts will improve the lives of countless Nigerians and serve as a model for other African countries. Announced by President Obama in 2013, Power Africa is working with sub-Saharan African governments, the private sector, and other partners, including Nigeria, to add more than 30,000 megawatts of cleaner, more efficient electricity generation capacity and 60 million new connections by 2030. The initiative has already helped financially close over 4,000 megawatts worth of transactions, representing almost 14% of the initial 30,000 megawatt goal. In Nigeria, Power Africa supports the strengthening of the energy sector through credit enhancement, grants, technical assistance, and investment promotion efforts. Power Africa is also working to mobilize affordable and long-term financing to support capital and operational expenditure requirements for successor generation and distribution companies to accelerate electricity market development. The United States is proud to partner with Nigeria to help meet the country's power needs for a better future for the people of Nigeria and Africa.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.